From KQED-FM in San Francisco, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Today, while we're in San Francisco, we'll look at some of the city's rock history. In the late 60s, when San Francisco was famous for its free concerts and psychedelic bands, Bill Graham was the businessman on the scene. Coming up, we meet Bill Graham, who has become one of the world's leading concert producers. Also today, we talk with Mickey Hart, drummer with the Grateful Dead. On his travels with the Dead, he's recorded musicians and singers from around the world. Those tapes have just been released on CD in a new world music series. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about San Francisco's earlier rock bands, and guest commentator Stuart Brand gives us a brief history of another subculture of the San Francisco area, the high-tech Silicon Valley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Fresh Air is in San Francisco today, where the annual public radio conference is underway. We're broadcasting from the studios of KQED-FM. And my guest is one of San Francisco's internationally known residents. Bill Graham was the key concert producer behind the San Francisco rock scene of the late 60s. He's now arguably the world's best-known rock impresario. From 1968 to 71, he ran the Fillmore West in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York, two of the most important rock theaters of the time. Over the years, he's branched out into virtually every aspect of concert and tour production, artist management, and merchandising. In the last few years, he's also co-produced blockbuster concert benefits, such as Live Aid and the Amnesty International Human Rights Tours. This month, he's co-producing a series of San Francisco concerts to benefit the fight against AIDS. When Bill Graham got into the rock business, in parts of the counterculture, business was a dirty word.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free, because to a great extent it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, or any connotation of business, or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society. You
know. Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life. The most joyous, because it was all new and was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free, electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality, at that time, with the power to the people syndrome, was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day? There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free, or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me, if it was Latin or jazz or R&B. And knowing that the Airplane or the Dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about the drawer. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry and all the Staples singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the film became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where you, my God, if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. And we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri, to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia, to talk to Otis Redding, to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance. To this day, my fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in, we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones. Another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me and it was all new for them. It was the most exciting time of my life.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is the world's best-known rock impresario, Bill Graham, and we're broadcasting today from San Francisco. So on the one hand, you were dealing with a lot of people who thought that the music should be free. On the other hand, you were also dealing with the music industry, which wasn't really prepared for the kind of countercultural, psychedelic kind of groups that you were frequently working with.
And the success level. And eventually once we started dealing with groups outside of San Francisco, mm-hmm. then we had to deal with business agents and managers. And
what were some of the most difficult things about that initially?
Well, there was an attempt on our part from the very onset to do more than just put the act on the stage. I'd been involved with theater prior to that. I was also a waiter for many years, and I've dealt with people all my life, driving a cab, but listening to and thinking about the attitudes and the human relations, and had great thoughts about what do I do with you once I rip your ticket. What happens to you when you come inside here? So from the very beginning, after the first few weeks, I remembered that when I used to go to shows at 2 o'clock in the morning, whenever the show was over, somebody would blow a whistle, the lights would go on, and people would be taken out of whatever space they were in. So from the beginning, I said, leave the lights low, let's get a mirror ball, put the mirror ball on, put slides of flowers on the screen, put these tapes on. A few weeks later, let's put some balloons out on the floor. People are coming in here. They don't really know each other, and some of them might be shy because the film has got this reputation. Maybe they'll hit the balloons towards each other. Or let's put some news articles on the wall on corkboard and the events of the day and anybody in our company that has interesting articles that the public might want to see. Or let's put apples at the top of the stairs for anybody that wants an apple. This took time, people, and some money. Convincing artists that part of the expenses of coming here is X. It might be $200, $300. Eventually, I think it ended up costing us $1,100 a week just for apples. Trying to convince a manager, an artist, that before you go into percentage, so you'd pay an artist X number of dollars, and once we hit so many people, then we take the expenses of the house up, then the profits. But part of the expenses are the light show. Well, many managers said, well, we'll come in, but we don't want to pay for those things because they're not essential. And I'd say, yes, they are. That's what this, instead of tablecloths and knives and forks, we have light shows and apples and balloons. So it was very difficult to explain what we were all about because, to some extent, what the film was not just an expression of the artist on that stage. It was our company's expression on how we run this facility.
I'm not sure why I'm asking this, but did you ever get any of the groups that you managed on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Jefferson Airplane and Santana.
Well, what was it like to do that? It just seems like it must have been very strange to get the Jefferson Airplane, you know, in the mid or late 60s onto Ed Sullivan.
Well, it was strange they were business people and you had to be there for the sound check at such and such a time, and they sent the cars to the hotels, and that was all fine. The main concern at that time with the stage manager there and the producers were, what are they going to do physically? Are they going to be gyrating? Is there anything going to happen below the waist that we should know about in advance? Because that was also the time period of Elvis Presley and the Beatles, and so that they were very worried about lyrics. and physicalness.
They weren't worried about drugs.
No, they weren't too much. On another event, when we went down to Southern California with another group to another TV show, we had an amazing scene where they guarded us with security people to make sure that we didn't touch anything or put anything into anything.
In the film, or East and West, I mean, everybody on stage and in the audience was either smoking or dropping acid or something. I mean, there was a lot of drugs in the late 60s. In those concert halls, I was wondering what your attitude was toward law enforcement. If you ever, talked with the police, if there was an understanding that there would be no police inside, no bus inside.
Well, first, that's a great exaggeration. I'm not going to sit here and say it didn't go on, but it wasn't that almost everybody. Some people... here in the Bay Area, in New York, there was a very serious fire law. There was no smoking allowed in the theater, and once in a while you'd get a guy, copping a hit from under the seat, and people might have come in already having put something in their bodies prior to coming in. But the law was very strict back mm-hmm. east.
Who'd you have enforcing it?
There were many times that we had a staff, and we would try to do it as lighthearted as possible. I'd make a T-shirts, and it would say, on the front of the shirt, it would say, please, and on the back it would say, I'm not just another usher. So when we don't do that, and there were many, many times when I went on the stage and said, look, I'm tired of paying $500 fines. If you want to close the theater, this is in New York, light up, and let's have one grand night tonight, and that's the end of the film war. And more often than not, people heeded that warning.
Now, you closed the film war, East and West, in 1971.
Correct.
What were your reasons?
Sometimes the thing that breaks your back is a slight thing, but there were things leading up to it. I had been having considerable problems having groups continue to play there. Rock and roll became very, very popular in 70, 71, 72, and many of the groups wanted to play a Madison Square Garden or the Cow Palace because they were becoming more successful. And at that time, I was having many problems with managers and agents, fighting off this price avalanche that bands said, but we can earn $100,000 up there. I said, well, play there, but also play here. But in early 71, one of the few heroes that I had was a great international impresario of show business named Saul Hurok. And he had called me, and I went to see him, that he had a month's cancellation in April of 71. At the Metropolitan Opera House, that the Stuttgart Ballet had to cancel, and would I be interested in coming in and co-producing a series of events with him there? And I thought it was a great opportunity to even further legitimize rock and roll, and I thought some of the quality bands like the Byrds and the Band and the Mothers of Invention, many of them could go into the Metropolitan Opera House. And I began lining them up, but a particular phone call that I received from a manager of a band who returned my phone call when I said, this is a great opportunity for your group to go into the Metropolitan Opera House. It's a very expensive building, but isn't it great to be able to do that? And he returned my call right after a late show at the Fillmore, and I was sitting in the office around 3 in the morning. And when he said, what's the money? I said, well, for the week, for 6 shows, you can make $50,000, which was still a lot mm-hmm. of money. But in rock and roll terms, it had already become not so high when you realize what you can earn somewhere else. And his exact words to me were, you expect my boys to work for a lousy 50 grand a week? That did it.
So you closed up.
Yeah.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
Is this the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
Seven Up, was it?
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
Well, they played the Fillmore quite often, and there was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the film to be the same. And I I push that very strongly because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists, and I have no right to tell them what they need to do as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up. Just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at Dead shows when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And then I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there. Except then some 7-Ups, you know, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone, who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, you know, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked if
this
I wanted to...
This is the drummer from the Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys. And I said, no, you know, I just introduced the band. He said, well, we'll only play if you come on stage and here's a drumstick and why don't you lead the band and tell us what songs you want to hear and whatever that is, we'll just play that and we'll keep going all night long. Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night and just hit the cymbals, you know, and hit the barbells and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated
Not
the day
at all.
After?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout, and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well. And just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No?
No. But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used to this day, doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. There's no tumbling drum set, and the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union, and I'm very much in favor of that.
I want to talk with you more about your life and about the rock business, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Bill Graham, who is probably the world's best-known rock impresario. This is Fresh Air.
Today's Fresh Air was produced at KQED FM in San Francisco and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're broadcasting today from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. My guest is Bill Graham, and we're talking about the rock business and the rock world. The rock world has become much more corporation-dominated than it's ever been before. What strikes you as the turning point or turning points?
Well, very much so. Woodstock, when the New York Times prints that 400,000 people got together in one space. I always have this image of somebody reading the Wall Street Journal the next day or New York Times, and the wax mustache is in. He's just spinning the ends. So, oh my, that's business, you know, whenever you get lots of people together, whatever it is. Numbers, and when you get into Time and Newsweek, and it tells you that you have substance in the business world. And that was the turning point. I mean, it, of course, it went far beyond, in 69, it was still against the grain. It was not de rigueur to endorse products and have your name on merchandise and headbands and endorse cars and beer. But eventually America wins, or the mercantile system wins. And I'm not here to take sides, but I do have a very strong feeling that it's not nearly what it was for me.
Well, you know, I mean, you have something of a rock empire yourself, but it's not like the really large corporations, the multinationals who are sponsoring some of the rock mm-hmm. tours. Do you feel that some of your business is being taken away by the corporate sponsors who are underwriting some of the really large rock tours?
Well, not really. I mean, there was a situation recently where the decision had to be made on our part, for example, here locally, we built an amphitheater and spent most of my savings to build this facility. But the one thing that an opportunity that I had was to be we were offered substantial millions of dollars to allow signage, corporate signage, inside the facility. And I have always felt very strongly that when somebody buys a ticket and sits down to look at the stage, that there is nothing, there are no cars being thrown at you, or cigarettes being thrown at you, or soft drinks, that you came to see that artist. You go to other facilities, and if you want to watch that baseball game, you're going to see that guy chasing that ball, and right behind him is a sign to buy something, or go somewhere, or do something with something. To the best of my ability, I've tried very hard not to do that. And I'm rock and roll is part of big business. And I have become part of that, and I can't be that hypocritical. I don't nearly enjoy a show in a stadium as much as I enjoy in a show in a theater. And if my saying no would mean that artist would play in a theater, I would do so. But if an artist can earn in one stadium show what it would take him a week to earn in a theater, he invariably makes a decision to play in the stadium, because in the end, it means less time on the road earning a living and more time to partake with the pleasures of having made it. So instead of being on the road for 3 months earning X, he might be able to do it in 2 months, and I can't deny him that, but yet I'm not in favor of it. I would just as soon work 5 nights in a theater and earn the same amount of money as I would in 1 night in a stadium.
Bill Graham is my guest. For the past few years, you've been doing a lot of really big benefits, Live Aid, the Amnesty International tours, a big crack benefit concert in New York, and you've got you're co-producing a series of concerts to concerts against AIDS coming up in San Francisco. How did you get into doing that?
It's not really getting into anything. That came from the meme troupe days of just being involved with the community. I'm always leery about how to state this, because people think, well, he must be covering up something. Is it public relations? Is it an image? It's very simple, that we have a certain talent, and I have a certain talent in public assemblage and producing shows. And I live in this community, and I'm concerned about this planet. I don't perform. Anytime anyone approaches us regarding a project that I think is valid, if it's to raise money to save the library, send kids to camp, whatever it might be, if it's valid, I then try to explain to you what our services are. You, who come to us with the project, need to have the bands commit. If the bands commit, we will drive the bus. We will sell the tickets. We will get the sound and lights. And we cover our expenses. We never want to make a profit. But that is our strength, so that you can go to an artist and say, we want to save this recreational pool, and will you play? But if they say to you, well, how will you produce the show? You don't know how to do that. We do. So you can say, well, BGP will do that. That is our service, and that's the best way that we can put back. Just the way the Grateful Dead can put back, or the Bruce Springsteen can, or Sting, the way they can put back is by being the power that draws the people there to buy the ticket.
Did you ever want to get out of the rock world altogether?
Yes. In the early 70s, when the big change really began, when I began to realize that it wasn't going to be the way I had it wasn't going to stay the way I had hoped it would stay. That rock and roll became the international language, and it became a huge business. The bigger it got, the further away it got, because it became less personal. We live in a survivalist state now, and the majority of the people go to concerts to be entertained. They do not go there to exchange dialogue and communicate about the problems of the day. At times they do, if it's a particular group that speaks to them that from that angle. But that basic difference has taken its toll on my love for the work.
But you're staying anyway.
I stay because I think we have a very good company, and I like the people in our company, and I respect the quality of their character and the quality of the work of our staff, which is more important to me than any particular artist.
When you got into this business, you didn't know much about rock music.
No.
Do you like it now? Do you enjoy listening to it?
Less than half, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
I like some of the music, and the lyrics, but for my other than a handful of groups that I listen to voluntarily, my music for pleasure is not rock and roll.
What is it?
Latin music, and some classical, not that much, but mainly percussive music, African, Brazilian, Central American.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever had any embarrassing moments where someone confused you with the evangelist Billy Graham?
A number of times. There were two particular moments. Once I placed I didn't have a credit card yet, and I placed a collect call from the east to the west, and the operator said, "Yes, what number are you calling?" And he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Bill Graham." And she said, "The evangelist Billy Graham?" And I said, "No." She said, "Oh, hold on." She was very disappointed. But there was one particular time when I was in New York with my kids, who were very young at the time. And we were staying at a hotel. And one of them had seen this, a friend of us had this particular little train. And we were staying right around the corner from F.A.O. Schwartz. And it was a rainy day. And I said, "All right, be calm, stay cool. I'm going to go out with a friend of mine." And another friend of mine was staying with him to babysit at the hotel, and I went to F.A.O. Schwartz. They didn't have the exact model that he wanted, so I figured before I get this one or that one, I'll call him and explain to him what was here. So I called the hotel, and I had forgotten my room number, and I said, "Bill Graham." And a man picked up the phone and said, "Yes." And I said, "Put David on," is my son. He said, "I beg your pardon. Come on, come on." And he said, "Come on, put David." He said, "Who do you wish to speak with?" I said, "Don't give me any crap, just put..." And the voice then said, "This is the Reverend Billy Graham speaking." And they had connected me at that hotel with him. I said, "I beg your pardon." And that was that.
Did you meet?
No. I did get the train, and it was the right train, though.
Great story. Well, Bill Graham, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us while we're in San Francisco. Fresh Air is coming to you today from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From San Francisco, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're broadcasting from San Francisco today, and our guest is drummer Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. While traveling with the Dead during their worldwide tours to such places as India, Africa, and Egypt, Hart took his Nagra tape recorder into remote regions to record the local music. He's produced those tapes into a new series of CDs. Coming up, I talk with Mickey Hart about world music and the Grateful Dead. If you think the San Francisco rock scene starts with bands like the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane, rock historian Ed Ward has some earlier bands he wants you to hear. And we have a quick history of the Silicon Valley from guest commentator Stuart Brand, the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Secretary of State James Baker met today with Venezuela's foreign minister. Baker sought the meeting to press his case for approval of an Organization of American States resolution demanding the removal of Panamanian military ruler General Manuel Noriega. The OAS is to meet this evening on the resolution. The Venezuelan foreign minister is expected to play a key role in the proceedings, partly because the meeting was being convened at Venezuela's initiative. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev had some advice for Chinese leaders who are dealing with the largest demonstration since the communists took over 40 years ago. More than a million people took to the streets in central Beijing today, forcing more changes in Gorbachev's schedule during his historic trip to China. Details from the BBC's Jeremy Harris.
Mr. Gorbachev said he wouldn't take it upon himself to judge what was happening in China. That was a task for the Chinese. A difficult process was going on. He hoped solutions would be found that were acceptable to both sides. When asked how he'd handle a similar situation in Red Square in Moscow, the Soviet leader replied that he'd try to solve it through political means. Earlier, in an interview for Chinese television, Mr. Gorbachev said that in his limited contacts with young people in Peking, he'd been pleased with their commitment to rapid reform, but perhaps they wanted more than was possible right away. Later, he added, I would counsel patience. I know how important that is. Indeed, if the last few days have been remarkable for the Chinese people, they've also been fairly extraordinary for Mr. Gorbachev. A world statesman with an enviable reputation for his ability to steal the limelight wherever he goes has been upstaged.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris in Beijing. The House of Representatives voted to approve today a federal budget of more than $1 trillion for next year. The Senate is expected to follow suit tomorrow. Though the House vote of 241 to 185 was a bipartisan one, NPR's Cokie Roberts reports that partisanship erupted in the House on other matters today.
The budget approved by the House closely followed the bipartisan agreement arrived at earlier this year between Congress and the Bush administration. But the constraints imposed by the budget and the necessity to hold down the deficit kept another measure from House approval today. An emergency spending bill designed primarily to keep veterans' hospitals paying their bills became enmeshed in a partisan political battle over whether to add close to $500 million for the war on drugs. Democrats, who wanted to include the drug money, thought they could embarrass Republicans into voting against it. The parliamentary situation did not allow that today, but the spending bill is likely to come back to the House floor later this week, and Republicans will be forced to vote on the drug package. They will also have to decide how to handle a presidential veto of a bill to raise the minimum wage, which the Senate approved today. Though Democrats know they don't have the votes to override the veto, which Mr. Bush has promised, they hope to score some political points on the popular measure. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
A tornado swept through a central Texas town early today, killing one person, injuring at least 24 others, and destroying an apartment complex while residents slept. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, hundreds of people were forced to evacuate to higher ground, and two people were killed when their vehicles were swept away in rain-swollen creeks. In addition to Texas, which got 7 inches of rain in some parts, flood warnings were issued for parts of Louisiana and parts of Oklahoma. In the Washington-Baltimore area, the rain stopped after 13 straight days of precipitation, the longest stretch in 40 years of record-keeping. The captain of the Exxon Valdez drank alcoholic beverages with shipmates while ashore before the tanker struck a reef in Prince William Sound. That, according to documents released today by the National Transportation Safety Board, which is holding hearings in Anchorage on the spill. This is NPR News in Washington.
We're broadcasting Fresh Air from San Francisco today. You know, earthquakes are not the only force that have shaken up the city. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says back in the late 50s and early 60s, San Francisco's vibrant music scene was already breaking new ground.
The San Francisco sound that became popular during the Summer of Love in 1967 was pretty much a laugh to people who lived in San Francisco. Everybody knew that the famous bands were from somewhere else. Country Joe and the Fish were from Berkeley, Quicksilver Messenger Service from Marin County, and the Grateful Dead were from San Mateo or somewhere down on the peninsula where only the hardy dared to go. It was true that they'd gotten famous playing in San Francisco's ballrooms, the Fillmore and the Avalon, but as far as there being a native San Francisco music scene, the throngs on Haight Street were a couple of years too late.
Come on, everybody! Come on in! Bobby's gonna show you how to do the swim! Kinda like the monkey, kinda like the twist. Pretend you're in the water.
Bobby Freeman was San Francisco's first hitmaker, starting in 1958 with his classic Do You Want to Dance, and continuing on to his 1964 hit Come On, Do the Swim, the record that put Autumn Records onto the map. Autumn was the label that documented a lot of the birth of the San Francisco scene because its owners, Tom Donahue and Bobby Mitchell, two DJs who were on Top 40 station KYA, were in the best position to see what was going on. To help them out, they hired a 21-year-old Texas-born kid named Sylvester Stewart to produce the records and co-write some of them. As they say in the business, the kid had ears. He took a fairly green band, a hooker friend of Donahue's had discovered, into the studio and sent them straight to the top.
I hate to say it, but I told you so. Don't mind my preaching to you. I said, don't trust them, baby, now you know. You don't learn everything there is to. Wouldn't believe me when I gave advice. I said that he was a tease. If you won't help, you better ask me nice. So be sincere, convince me with a pretty face.
Laugh, laugh, before I die. It seems so funny to me.
The Beau Brummels were exactly the kind of folkish, rocking band people were looking for in 1965. Which is undoubtedly how a group of San Francisco State University students, who called themselves We Five, wound up with an A&M Records deal and a one-shot hit. But 1965 was the watershed year. A group of odd people who'd been taking lots of LSD hit upon a plan, move to Nevada and try to take the state over. They started by taking over Virginia City, an all but defunct mining town, and with the Red Dog Saloon as their base of operations, they recruited a house band from a bunch of artists and misfits they knew in San Francisco. The Charlatans, as they were known, probably because they knew as well as anybody how poorly they played, were soon commuting between Virginia City and Frisco, wearing cowboy clothes and Edwardian velvet jackets, carrying real guns, and sporting very long hair.
Woo-hoo, I think I'm gonna die. Woo-hoo, I think I'm gonna cry. Oh, baby, I just know.
The Charlatans cut this number, number one, as a demo for Autumn Records in 1965, and a year or so later, they almost released a version of Buffy St. Marie's Codeine, but despite this lack of documentation, they were one of the first of the new breed. Nor were they the only ones taking LSD. Tom Donahue was getting further and further out, too, and opened a club called Mother's right on Broadway in the middle of Topless City. There, he found a band he thought had potential, but they drove Sylvester Stewart nuts. After 50 takes, though, they had a single in the can.
When the truth
Even then, the bass was still out of tune, but Grace and Darby Slick were probably too stoned to tell, and the Great Society, as the band called itself, failed to make any impression. By this time, Autumn Records was going under. Donahue was incapable of doing business. His partner Bobby Mitchell had developed Hodgkin's disease and knew he was going to die, and they sold the label and all of its artist contracts to Warner Brothers, which was just getting into the record business. It was 1966, another year, and Donahue would have had a gold mine because the new bands didn't trust establishment labels too much. And before long, everybody was echoing Bobby Mitchell's last words. What was that? Thanks to Gene Scalati and Bob Simmons for help with this piece.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Stay away from the pool halls and the taverns. Stay away from the man pushing that codeine around. Stay away from the stores where the remedies are fine. Much better your pain than be caught on codeine.
This is Fresh Air. We're in San Francisco today, broadcasting from the studios of KQED-FM. The Bay Area is home to the Grateful Dead. They're not just a band, they're a phenomenon. They were probably the most celebrated psychedelic band of the 60s. They've been together for more than 22 years, and throughout that time, they've had a following of fans, deadheads, so loyal that they've made it their life's work to follow the Dead on the road. Mickey Hart is one of the Dead's two drummers. He joined the band in 1967. But playing with the band is just one aspect of his musical life. While traveling with the Dead around the world, Hart has taped singers and musicians from Africa, India, and the Middle East. Now that there's a growing interest in world music, Hart has produced his recordings from the 70s and 80s into a series of CDs on the Ryko disc label. The series includes Hart's 1978 recording of Nubian singer, songwriter, and oud player Humza Eldin.
I got a coney and only go.
Has it been touring around the world with the Grateful Dead that's introduced you to a lot of the musicians who
no,
you've recorded?
No, not really. Mostly it was the Folkways collection that when I was a kid, I listened to a lot of these world music collections, and it brought the world into my living room, and it brought it alive. And that's where, and also the music on the streets, the Latin music, was what first gave me a hit of Western, of non-Western music, of third world music.
So while you were touring with the Dead, you were able to go to the musicians of different countries see them perform.
That's right.
Would you have to get to know somebody pretty well before being able to record them?
Oh, yes. You have to hang out, and you have to take part in the local customs. And so you have to have a stomach for this. This is something that is not what you want to do every day unless you really wanted to do it. It takes patience. There's a lot of it's very time-consuming.
How are the recordings that you made in the 70s and 80s released now on Ryko Disc? What's the story behind that?
Well, it began in the early 70s with my interest in Naga recording, and also seeing all the world music passing in front of me not being recorded. So I just ran tape. It was actually very selfish in those days. I just wanted a great recording of the world's music to listen to at night. It was curl up with a cup of cognac or something and sit up there, and it was sort of my wine cellar, my chateau, you know. And then, of course, a lot of these musics became so rare that they disappeared or on the endangered music list. And with the ecology being as frail as it is, these musics are attached to it, you know, to the rainforest. When a rainforest goes, the music of the rainforest goes. So now it's becoming more valuable because it's rarer. And it's become, people want to hear it now. And that's why I released it.
How has your exposure to world music changed your playing as a drummer and percussionist?
Oh, geez. It's hard to describe. I mean, in every which way you can imagine. You know, my sensibilities are completely different now than when I came out of school. I mean, I've learned to listen and play from a spiritual side and not necessarily a technical side. So, I mean, it's affected me deep, not only in my technique, but in the sensibility in which I approach the music.
One of the recordings on the Ryko Disc series is of your group, the Digga Rhythm Band, which, well, give us an idea of who's on it.
Oh, Digga was the maestro, Zakir Hussain, who's Alaraka's son, and about the finest percussionist on the planet now. And we put this together in the mid-70s, and it's a sort of a 20th century gamelan made of tuned percussion from all over the world. And this was this is the jewel of the collection, one of the jewels.
And what are you playing on this?
Oh, I play timpani, traps, drum set, dozens of instruments.
Playing with rock groups for over 20 years now.
Way over 20 years.
Way over 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
How does it affect your hearing, especially as the drummer? You're kind of in the middle of the loudest part.
You might say I'm in the middle of a lot of stuff. Well, there are certain frequencies in my hearing that aren't as sharp as others. After a tour, it takes me a while. I read lips for about a week or so, and then it goes away, and then I'm pretty normal. But there are a few places in my hearing that have cuts and drop out, and I'm aware of them, and I take them into consideration. Like little birdies up in the tree way far away are a little hard for me to hear sometimes. But then I can hear up to 18,000 cycles, 19,000 cycles.
Does this ever interfere with either your ability to hear more quiet musicians play or your ability to mix stuff?
Not the quiet. The quiet part, my ears tune in, and they focus on the quiet. See, in the Grateful Dead, it's huge volume. I'll admit there is lots of volume, but it's really clean. There's no square waves. There's no distortion. Everything is pure. So you can take a lot of volume, and if the sound is pure and not distorted, you know, with whining guitars, all of our guitars just are very crystal, and they all sing, and they're all in tune, and it's a very pristine sound, even though it comes to you at 140, 130 dB.
Your father managed the band for a short time.
That's right.
In 1970, I think he joined. How did that happen, that your father became the band's manager?
Well, we really weren't into the business. We never really looked at the business, and we were failing miserably. We were owing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And my father had business experience. Even though he was a crook, of course, I didn't know that then. And he was the only one around that knew how to sign a check or anything. Or really, you know, we just went into playing. We were just mad kids, you know, just trying to play music every minute of the day. And we just didn't want to be bothered by the world. So he managed us, and, of course, turned out that he was a crook and stole lots of money from the band. And, you know, it's just a big, horrible story.
Well, when he left the band, the Dead put out a warrant for his arrest for embezzling,
that's not
didn't
true.
They?
No, the police did. It wasn't
Dead.
No, the Grateful Dead don't put people in jail. He just stole money, you know. I mean, it wasn't like he killed us or anything. So They prosecuted him. It wasn't the band.
Uh-huh. Were you embarrassed?
Embarrassed? That was a mild. That was a. That's one way to put it. I was disgraced. Actually, it was disgraceful. You know that your father should steal from a son, especially from the Grateful Dead, which was like Santa Claus. Grateful Dead never hurt anybody. He was just a crook. He just happened to be my father.
So.
You can't choose your father.
Well, how did that change your relationship with him?
Well, I never saw him again, you know, until he died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I buried him, and that was that.
Huh. Were you in a period with the Grateful Dead ever of doing, like, a whole lot of drugs while performing?
Oh,
like, taking
a lot
of acid?
Of course,
yeah,
the Grateful
yeah.
Dead collectively did psychedelics in the early days, and that was one of the things that based its music on, the collective experience of psychedelics.
When did you stop using psychedelics?
In the 70s.
What was the reason for stopping?
Well, it's really hard to take care of the kids high on acid and stuff, you know? You know what I mean? It's just not done. It's irresponsible. And with the family and with other responsibilities. And once you've been there, you've been there. And it just was going back to the same old place. And when we took psychedelics, it was more of a sacrament. You know, it was trying to find a higher order. It wasn't going ya-ya in the trees, you know, in the woods, just going out there and partying at the beach with beer. I mean, the only time we did it was when we played, and it was sort of like church to us. It was like that kind of experience.
Do you expect the dead to stay together for years to come?
Oh, I think so. I think as long as that we're up and we love to play, it'll stay together as long as we're healthy. I would like to turn the clock myself. I would like to take this into the 2000s. That's sort of what I had in mind. But you never can tell. I mean, the Grateful Dead is a gigantically strong thing, but it's also like walking on eggshells. You know, it's very delicate. So we'll see.
Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart. Here's more of the Diga Rhythm Band with Hart and Zakir Hussain, produced by Hart for the World Series of Recordings on the Ryko Disc label. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington. On our program this evening, perhaps more than a million people have gathered in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, in China. And we'll talk with Orville Schell, the writer who describes what he's seen there over the past couple of days, including now people from all aspects of Chinese societies joining with the students in protest. A general strike against the Noriega regime in Panama has not been an overwhelming success. The Organization of American States begins an emergency session here in Washington to take up the question about what to do with Panama. And we'll talk with Ian Frazier about his book, Great Plains, and the story of Nicodemus, Kansas, small town settled in the 1870s by black homesteaders from Kentucky and Tennessee. That's all coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Back in the 60s, Stuart Brand created the Whole Earth Catalog, a guide for those interested in alternative resources and lifestyles. But Stuart Brand is not one to live in the past. Nowadays, from his base out here in the Bay Area, he spends a lot of time thinking about the future, about new technologies and how they'll affect our lives. From time to time, Stuart will be letting us in on what's new, but for starters, a short history of the Silicon Valley.
It's the most talked about feature of the San Francisco Bay Area, but no tourist comes to visit it because there's nothing to see. Silicon Valley isn't so much a place as a concatenation of ambitions in a high-velocity marketplace. The computer business hasn't time for monuments. I'm old enough, I'm 50, to remember the famous miles of groves of oranges and other fruit that perfumed the spring nights from San Jose most of the 35 miles north to San Francisco. Then it was a tourist attraction, and the university I attended there in the late 50s, Stanford, was still called the farm without much irony. But even then, the groves were doomed, thanks to my alma mater. It's not widely known that Silicon Valley was invented on purpose. The inventor was a brilliant professor of electrical engineering at Stanford named Frederick Terman. Two of his brighter students were David Packard and Bill Hewlett. In 1939, they did some inspired fiddling in the first of the area's renowned garages and wanted to start a company. Professor Terman suggested they set up shop nearby and keep in close touch with their old department at the university. So they did. Later, Terman, who was by then the chancellor at Stanford, urged the university to make some of its abundant land available as an industrial park. And one of the first invited to set up there was the ballooning electronics company of Hewlett-Packard. Going right along with Terman's plan, other such companies also were taking root in the area, and a critical mass of talent was formed. In just a few years, the orange groves became a high-tech mecca and industrial wasteland. It's a funny industry. These are not dark, satanic mills. The companies mostly look like an electrical engineering department gone private. They're so easy to start that everybody does. All you need is an idea or two, and there's a constant seething turnover in people and companies. The nice thing about it for us neighbors is that along with all the commercial ferment is considerable intellectual ferment. These are smart, adventurous people. The nuclear freeze movement of a few years ago, for example, was largely generated and sustained by the sharp minds and surplus wealth of Silicon Valley. Many of their nearby cohorts, of course, were busy at the same time devising the hardware and software for Reagan's Star Wars technology. The Russians and Japanese do serious spying here, and the locals spy right back. We wheel and deal in the electronic global marketplace from this Pacific shore, dancing at the edge of the world, as the local Indians used to sing it. Thanks to Silicon Valley, the San Francisco area is like a global frontier town these days, but then it always was.
Stuart Brand's latest book is The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. Marty Moscoane will be sitting in for me back in Philadelphia for the next couple of days while I attend a public radio conference here in San Francisco. Tomorrow, Marty speaks with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Richard Wilbur. In 1987, Wilbur became the second person to become Poet Laureate of the United States. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff tells us what he's been seeing at the Cannes Film Festival, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews John Cougar Mellencamp's new record. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia.
Before we pull up stakes from KQED, there are a lot of people we want to thank. Station manager David Hosley, program director Carol Pearson, news director Ann Marshall, promotion director Doug Edwards, engineers Howard Gelman and Ed Herman, and all the other staff at KQED who've made us feel so welcome. And special thanks to Monty, no problem, I'll make it work, Carlos. The Fresh Air team is Denny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Chris Spurgeon, Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Deborah Beagle, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Audrey Vlaitis, Ron Barron, and me, your no longer jet-lagged host, Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.